B, with regard to a pregnant female worker, over and above what Senate Bill 518 does. Now, I don't see how that addresses the policy thing that you've just spoken of. I don't see that at all. All it does is expand the potential obligations of an employer with regard to the situation, instead of clearly delineating what he or she will or will not do when someone gets pregnant. You give a broad, open-ended sanction to... am I missing something here?
Could I jump in on this?
Well, let me see. Are you asking the witness a question?
I'll ask anybody a question if they can explain that to me, but that's the way I read it.
If you follow it up with Section 2, which would become Section 3, which then reads the same way it does now, wouldn't that have the effect of defining this new Section 2, Sub 1? That is, the failure to accommodate would be the failure to transfer temporarily to a less strenuous or hazardous position. I mean, I think you go from the general to the specific. Would that be your understanding, Ms. Pruitt?
Yes, Senator Shoemaker, that's my understanding. Senator Grensky, it was not our intent to broaden what the bill was doing, merely to state in a bolder way exactly what the bill was doing, and we did not see any conflict between that last sentence and what the bill was already stating.
So what you're saying is that the rest of Section 1 would be part of your Section 2?
Yes, we're not seeking to delete anything in the bill.
Section 2 would become Section 3. This goes here, and then this continues as Section 3. If you look down here, they change the numbering. There it is.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Okay, it's a different policy statement.
Senator Houck.
Well, I happen to read it similar to Senator Grinsky here, and I think we had this argument 2 years ago, as I remember, the same amendments. And actually what you have here is three, or can be interpreted, three policies, or three points. If you look at line 3 to 7, and look at the period behind loss, you have basically a law that allows, has nothing to do with pregnancy, it just allows for a discrimination suit if you don't have reassignment or leaves for employees with non-job-related disability. That has nothing to do with pregnancies at that point. The second issue, beginning in line 7 and going to line 9, says basically what 518 says. It'll be an unlawful employment practice if you do certain things as far as related to childbirth and related conditions. That's what the bill says. The third thing, I'm not sure what it says or what the intent of it is. But I see three separate issues here that you're trying to broaden, or two of them, I think, you're trying to broaden 518. And I think that was your intent last session, as I remember. Didn't you submit the same identical amendments?
Senator Huck, the amendments weren't ever drafted by us. However, we had come to the committee with the same concerns.
Right.
And
okay,
again, my understanding is that the positions of our national affiliates is not to broaden this, merely to ensure that adequate protections will be contained in this law.
Well, let me finish here. Have I missed something in my analysis here with the two separate or the three separate issues here?
Well, Senator Howe,
let me put it another way. In line 3 to 7 of your amendments, would that entitle you to file an unfair or a discrimination suit against someone, an employer, that had not did not have policies for reassignment or leaves for employees with non-job-related disabilities?
Senator Houck, frankly, that was not our intent, and not knowing labor law as the committee may, I do not know whether that would be a possibility, and that's certainly something that the committee would want to look at. But I can honestly tell you it was not our intent to seek to address that in that part of the language.
Okay.
It does have that impact, though, because it simply says if you don't, if you haven't got that for anything else, you don't have to have it for this, therefore you obviate the rest of the bill. Isn't that what happens with your amendment?
Yeah. Senator Cairns, again, I don't know the ins and outs of labor law, and that would not be something that the Women's Rights Coalition would necessarily take a position on. As I've said, our intent with these amendments as drafted is to have additional protections if this bill goes forward. And so with the other implications of it, that's certainly something I could take back and form an opinion on.
Holly, the coalition would like to establish the intent. That's the intent. That's what this amendment is supposed to do. It's not to broaden the statutory authority or anything.
That's right.
I think we can put on the record and have it clearly on the record that as the chief sponsor of the bill and a proponent of the bill, it's not my intent that this be intended to establish any authority on the part of this state or any employer to interfere with the individual determination of a woman worker regarding appropriate conduct during pregnancy or childbirth. That's not what the bill does, and that's not what it's intended to do. The bill is to provide certain protections for a woman who is pregnant or has a related medical condition. But it's not intended, nor do I believe does it, extend new powers to the state or to an employer to interfere with that woman's own determinations about her pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
So if we have that clearly on the record, as the intent of the bill and what I believe to be the effect of the bill, it doesn't extend powers to the state or the employer in that regard. I think that should clearly resolve some of the concerns of the Women's Rights Coalition without needing to put an amendment on the bill.
I think I haven't heard otherwise from the committee, and I would certainly think that the committee would concur in that as our intent. We're not interested in going beyond what is printed in the bill and asserting rights not expressly stated in the bill or creating some invidious discrimination. Understand exactly where you're coming from and not wanting to go all the way back to the Oregon bakery case and say we're going to treat people differently based upon their gender, but rather treat individual cases individually, regardless of whether it's male, female, whatever the gender may be. Isn't that that's what you think we're doing here, isn't it? That's what you want us to do, and that's what the intent of this legislation would be, even without your amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do appreciate the statement for the record. However, the California law that this was based on originally was challenged as being in contradiction to the Pregnancy Disability Act, which does not allow for special treatment of pregnancy as aside from different disabilities, which this does. And as you know, the California Supreme Court did uphold that local law, and I don't know whether in Oregon it would be similarly upheld because we do have a different state constitution than California, and so it's our job to raise those issues and to hope that they're adequately addressed in the legislation.
Chairman, one more statement, I think, and we can make this further clear on the floor. The intent of Senate Bill 518 is not to provide any barrier for a woman in regards to obtaining employment or retaining employment, but rather is to eliminate what could be a barrier in a particular case. That is, the pregnancy-related disability could be a barrier to the person's ability to retain a job. We want to eliminate that barrier and, in that sense, put that woman on equal footing with a male who doesn't run the risk of pregnancy-related disabilities. So our intent is to remove barriers to employment, to full employment and participation in the workforce, and our intent is not to erect barriers. And I believe that the California case, which went to the Supreme Court, came to that conclusion, generally stated. That was the intent and the effect of the California law. Our intent and the effect we intend is the same.
Senator Shoemaker, Senator Howell.
Holly, have you had legal counsel on this? Is this amendment that you're proposing the result of a legal analysis that the Women's Rights Coalition did of Senate Bill 518 and a conclusion that it runs a risk of running afoul of the federal act?
Yes, the general position of the Women's Rights Coalition is derived from positions.
I'm asking you whether your specific amendments are the result of a lawyer's analysis of 518.
Yes, Senator Shoemaker, the amendments were originally drafted by Jean Atkins, who's an attorney who had served with the Women's Equity Action League in Washington, D.C., which had worked on these issues nationally, and she was the lobbyist of the Women's Rights Coalition who argued this in 1987. The amendments then, after Jean Atkins had prepared them, went to Kathleen Buffet for final tightening up in regards
Kathleen
to the
Kathleen would not have analyzed it from a constitutional perspective. She does drafting.
Right.
Did the person you first mentioned study 518 and conclude that it had a serious risk of running afoul of either the Constitution or the federal law?
Yes, Senator Shoemaker. And again, that had been flagged by national women's rights organizations.
Do you have a written legal opinion to that effect that you could provide us?
Senator Shoemaker, I do not have with me now
a
written
one?
Legal opinion. I will try, yes, and bring that to the committee.
Okay, because that would certainly help me. If I thought there was a significant risk that what we're trying to do here would not mm-hmm. pass muster legally, then I'd be much more inclined to go with the amendment.
Mm-hmm.
But if I, without it, I'm not at all sure.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that.
Much smaller point. Earlier you said that you were not intending in your section 2.1 to expand the requirements upon an employer as to what he needs to do mm-hmm. to accommodate a woman's pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
If that be true, then would you be willing to clarify that in line 8 of your amendment, where it says, and childbirth and related conditions or occurrences as provided in Section 3 constitutes an unlawful employment practice. And then Section 3 is our present Section 2, which says that you have to allow a female employee to transfer temporarily to a less strenuous position. In other words, make it clear that that Section 3 spells out what you need to do and doesn't open up a broader perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be an acceptable amendment to your amendment?
Senator Shoemaker, off the top of my head, I think so. I would want to take that back to my legislative committee for further analysis. If the committee were interested in pursuing these as amendments, yes, I'd be mm-hmm. glad to work on something that would be satisfactory to all.
Okay, well, I'm certainly interested in pursuing it if what we're trying to do here has a real legal problem to it.
Okay.
That I am.
Okay, well, I'll bring that information.
Thanks.
Further comments or questions? Senator Howe?
Holly, if when you talk to your legal counsel, there's two ways to approach the bill. One is from a problem with the employment practice in which they have here. The other one is that it is a problem with the employment practice because of the health, safety, and welfare, and that's kind of where we want to key off of that position to an employee,
mm-hmm.
and this speaks to one of the conditions that might happen as far as employment to pregnant women,
mm-hmm.
and if we approach it that way, and that's the way we did with 518,
because mm-hmm.
I think we really started on another vein 2 years ago on that.
Mm-hmm.
And pulled it back into more the protection of the employee and the offspring. I think that we've kind of gone back to where we tried to enter this thing with the amendments. That I see some. That I'm really concerned about the first portion of really opening it up to a discrimination suit here.
Mm-hmm.
Lines 1-7.
Ms. Talbot, you had a question?
A while back, it's not pertinent anymore.
Did we cover it?
Yeah. I'm not sure that this policy statement is intended, as Holly said. I'm not sure that it does, as written, expand. Senator Shoemaker's suggestion that you reference it to Section 3 may well accommodate your concern that it is trying to expand. But it is a
The problem is the period after loss. If you read that as one issue to the period after loss, and then you read the next one as an employer fails to accommodate.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, I see your problem.
Do you think that it is setting up?
I think it really sets up a possible
discrimination claim.
Right.
that goes 180 degrees.
Yeah.
If you struck that last sentence in subsection 1, that line, well, an employer's failure to.
Well, I think with Senator Schumacher's suggestion there, that pulls us right back to the to what's in 518.
Okay.
That's one issue. The first issue is the first seven lines. Then you have the 10 to 14, and I haven't quite sorted that one out.
Yeah, I was wondering about that as well. I don't want to,
Mr. Chairman.
Cut if you want to pursue that.
No, I'm fine.
Okay. What 10 to, lines 10 to 14 in the proposed amendment suggests that there's something in 518 as drafted that at least implies that there's some authority on the part of the state to interfere with the individual determination of a woman. I don't see it in there as I read it, but I don't dispute that perhaps it's there. So perhaps you could enlighten us on that. What is line 10 to 14 to accomplish? What's your concern?
Well, Senator Shoemaker, our concern is that there will be established, not in the bill, but in the proceedings on the bill, a legislative record of concern, again, about the outcome of a pregnancy, the state's interest in the outcome of a pregnancy, which would then pose a threat to a woman's right to individual determination regarding appropriate conduct during pregnancy. For example, we've heard testimony about the threats that industrial toxics can pose to the unborn fetus. Now, are we headed towards a day where we would say that then that woman is guilty of child abuse for exposing her child by going to work to those toxics, or that that employer is guilty of serious liability by having women workers who are pregnant or could be pregnant near that, near those toxics?
Well, how does a bill or a law that would require an employer to accommodate a woman's request to transfer temporarily to less strenuous or hazardous position during her pregnancy suggest an authority on the part of the state or an employer to interfere with a woman's individual determination? I don't get the connection there.
Again, Senator Shoemaker, there's nothing strictly in 518 stating that. However, we believe that that there may be support for 518 because there will be concern on the part of many legislators for ensuring that that the outcome of a pregnancy is in accordance with the state's interests rather than in accordance with the woman's rights. And that's why we were interested in having the committee affirm or establish legislative record about the woman's individual determination,
whether that's done
in the statute or just on the record.
Are you concerned that there might be an implication in 518 that this is the way to deal with the problem and that it would be contrary to a woman's right to have an abortion, for instance? That's what you're concerned about?
Senator Shoemaker, we're concerned that those issues are linked and related, and that even though technically that may not be found in 518, that and that we don't believe it is, that it's important for when we're taking action on this area to affirm what we believe the woman's right to individual determination regarding behavior during pregnancy is. And again, I don't believe that 518 does not do that. However, we felt that there would be greater protection afforded to really spell that out.
Let me ask you. Can I ask a question, Ron?
Yeah, go ahead. You have my permission.
Thank you. Let's cut to the chase. Would you take Senate Bill 518 as printed and consider it to be an acceptable piece of legislation dealing with the issue of empowering women in the workplace to determine what is the best for their needs as a result of pregnancy?
Mr. Chair, I cannot say at this moment whether the Women's Rights Coalition would actively oppose 518 as printed. We've come to let you know what we would prefer in terms of statement on the record and to have that included in the bill. And I can get that answer and bring it back to the committee regarding whether we would oppose it as printed.
Well, the reason I ask is we got 29 to zip the last time we took this issue up, and of course we've had some change in the makeup of the Senate, but it's a the issue is one of we've got an amendment which is trying to hammer down two areas which by your testimony are not included in the bill as printed, and at that point I'm wondering why we want to put it in the bill if we are all in agreement that 518 as printed does not express or imply either of those things that you're trying to address with your amendment, and that in fact we're talking about fairly tangential kinds of concern as a result of your amendment. That's where I'm coming
from. Mr. Chair, I appreciate your point, and I also appreciate the fact that we have established the concerns that we have on the record here today.
Yeah, I would consider all of the, I would consider the record on the bill as we worked on it in 1987 to be the 1989 discussion of the bill to be an extension of those, and in keeping with the position the committee and the Senate made. Took at that time. Okay. Further questions of this?
Just another statement to further clarify. I already stated on the record it's not my intent or the intent of the language of the bill to establish any authority on the part of the state or any employer to interfere with the individual determination of a woman worker regarding appropriate conduct during pregnancy or after childbirth. I ought to add that this bill does not seek to assert police powers based on a state interest in the outcome of pregnancy. That we're absolutely clear on that. What we're doing is extending a protection to a woman who may suffer discrimination if we don't extend this protection, and that discrimination could restrict her ability to participate in the job market. So we're removing a barrier to a woman's full participation in the economy by the passage of 518. I'd also like to point out that the intent of the bill is not to create a new grounds for discrimination complaint. Procedure for complaint under the bill is very specific. It's an unfair employment practice, and it would be pursued through the established unfair employment practice process that Foley administers. So we're not establishing, nor do we intend to establish, a new grounds for discrimination complaint that doesn't previously exist in law.
Thank you all. It'd be the chair's interest in calling a panel of Colleen Haas, Carl Frederick, and Lisa, is it Trussell? Is that correct? Okay, why don't I call all three of you up, and while you're coming up, the other, it is the interest of the chair to go to work session on this bill, so I'm going to give the proponents of the bill a Hobbesian choice after we hear from this panel.
That's a 3-2 choice?
No, it's a 5-0. Either you can testify or we'll go to work session, their choice.
Mr. Chair, Carl Frederick with Associated Oregon Industries. To my right is Lisa Trussell, who is the Human Resource Manager for NORPAC Foods, Inc., one of our good members. I'd like to give kind of a, and to my left, would you like to introduce yourself? So I don't have to. Oh, wait. All right.
Go ahead.
Give a kind of a brief history of this whole area of pregnancy-related, parental leave-related, female-related issues, and kind of explain where we are at the present time. And then my two companions will give some practical problems that are inherent in Senate Bill 518. Senate Bill 714, which was passed by the 1977 Oregon legislature and effective October 4th, 1977, stated that, quote, women affected by pregnancy, childbirth, and related medical conditions or occurrences shall be treated the same for all employment-related purposes, including receipt of benefits under fringe benefit programs, as other persons not so affected but similar in their ability or inability to work by reason of physical condition, end of quote, and that's contained in ORS 659029. Then on October 31st, 1978, President Carter signed into law the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, Public Law 95-555, and the act is an amendment to Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prohibits, among other things, discrimination in employment on the basis of sex. The Pregnancy Discrimination Act makes it clear that because of sex or on the basis of sex as used in Title VII includes because of or on the basis of pregnancy, childbirth, or related medical conditions. Therefore, Title VII prohibits discrimination in employment against women affected by pregnancy or related conditions. The basic principles of the state and the federal laws are that women affected by pregnancy and related conditions must be treated the same as other applicants and employees on the basis of their ability or inability to work. A woman is therefore protected against such practice as being fired or refused a job or promotion merely because she is pregnant or has had an abortion. And she usually cannot be forced to go on leave as long as she can still work. Now, if other employees who take disability leave are entitled to get their jobs back when they are able to work again, so are women who have been unable to work because of pregnancy. So I think you could say that there's no question that women generally, and those women with pregnancy-related conditions specifically, are a protected class under both state and federal civil rights laws. This measure, in our opinion, and my two colleagues will explain in more exquisite detail the practical effect of it if it were to pass, but I think this measure would increase the responsibilities of an employer of pregnant employees. It would require an employer to permit a pregnant employee upon request, per request, to transfer to a less strenuous or less hazardous position, so long as the request may reasonably accommodate. Now, the bill does provide that an employer can request a medical opinion, but apparently the recommendation of the employee's personal physician is controlling. Again, if other physicians might disagree, it's controlling. Also, if the request for transfer cannot reasonably accommodate, the employee would be entitled to a leave of absence, permitting the pregnant employee to take a leave of absence during the pregnancy, quote, for a reasonable period of time, quote. Again, the opinion of the employee's personal physician is controlling and must be followed. And the term reasonable period of time could possibly be longer than the 12-week period allowed under the parental leave law passed last session. And there seems to be no attempt in the bill to coordinate the leave of absence period with that permitted under the current parental leave law, which could lead, I think in some scenarios, to a pyramiding of leave time in these situations. With that, I'll turn it over to Lisa Trussell.
Well, wait a minute.
Does she have a question?
Oh, good, right. Senator Howe.
Carl, now from a real practical standpoint, do you think that there would be any employer that would put a, or would order over the top of a physician, or order, if there was any doubt in their mind, a pregnant employee to do some work that may harm her? And where you say it takes the responsibility out.
Absolutely not. I think they would be very accommodating, and that's why I feel this type of law is unnecessary.
I guess the next thing is when you say that that it adds to the responsibility of an employer.
Imposes that duty through the law by the mere passage of this particular language.
But they have it right now, Carl.
You have to do this.
Well, but they have the responsibility right now to protect the health, safety, and welfare of their employees.
Under the Oregon Safe Employment Act. Under the Oregon Safe Employment Act, I would say they have that responsibility. So you don't need this.
Well, that's one way to look at it. Tell me the next thing, the act that you're quoting, is that under the some other section of law and under the unemployment?
659-029.
Okay.
Senator Shoemaker.
If I hear you correctly, Carl, you're saying you don't need this. The law already gives them this protection.
We would hope so.
If that be true, why do you care?
Why should you lock this into the statutes?
Well, if you have it anyway, what difference does it make?
Well, it one of the witnesses will explain how this could lead to certain mischief on the part of certain employees if this were locked into the statutes.
So there are some differences.
There are some situations, yes. But okay. They could take advantage just by virtue of the fact it is in the law, you see. But I think from a practical standpoint is what I'm talking about. Employers are very accommodating in these situations. But this could be a real problem. Well, I can give you a good example. It wasn't with respect to this particular bill, but it was looking through my file. I received a letter from a personnel manager from a rather significant electronics firm, and if I may read it to you, and I'll leave it as part of the record. When talking in the abstract, it sounds easy to say disabilities caused by pregnancy will be treated the same as other disabilities. It's quite another thing to explain what you mean by that. Normal pregnancy is a state of good health, not illness. At what point does a woman with a normal pregnancy begin to experience disability caused by pregnancy? This is the point, and it touches on this in 518. At first, we naively assumed the treating physician would answer the question. However, we found this assumption to be false. Practically, our first claim was from an employee who was 3 months pregnant and whose doctor said she needed to stop work. When we asked the doctor what was the matter with her, he said, quote, nothing. But she said the employer had a program to pay pregnant women and she needed a note from her doctor, end of quote. We, of course, did not pay her disability benefits until much later in her pregnancy, but that claim was symptomatic of what we repeatedly encountered. Some employees thought that being pregnant was the same as being disabled. When some women found out after becoming pregnant that this was not the case, they were unhappy about having to continue work. The idea that pregnancy is a state of good health is the key here, end of quote. And I'll leave this letter with you.
So, referring to the last sentence in, well, beginning on line 13, the leave is not required to be granted with pay unless so specified by agreement of the employer and the employee, by collective bargaining agreement, or by employer policy. So I guess your concern is that if there was a collective bargaining agreement...
needed.
Senator Hill?
I was just going to comment on the statute we've got. The statute we have prohibits discrimination within a plan. So if there's a plan, a disability plan, and it does exist, pregnancy can't be discriminated against. There's nothing that guarantees reinstatement or job protection in the existing statute, which is why we have 518. I wanted to ask, Julia, in your collective bargaining agreement, how does it treat sick leave and vacation leave if you had to take time off because of a disability related to your pregnancy? Do you have any idea how sick leave and vacation leave would be treated under that?
We don't, in our collective bargaining agreement, we don't accrue sick leave at a set rate. We're entitled to medical benefits after a certain waiting period and a certain portion of our normal pay when medical authorities, doctors, state that we are indeed medically disabled.
Okay, so the doctor is the controlling factor there. The doctor says you're disabled.
Right.
That's the ruling
opinion.
Okay. I appreciate you taking the time and taking a personal leave to, at your expense, to give up a small portion of your benefits in order to come and share your thoughts with the committee, and I do appreciate you taking the time. An effort to do that. Good luck.
Before we, could I have that statutory reference?
Which statutory reference?
The one that Larry just referred to, the discrimination statute.
It's 029, 659, 029, and 030.
Okay.
Let's see.
The statute merely.
028, 029, and 030.
Okay.
Ms. Talbot.
That statutory site 029 merely defines what the term because of sex means to include that sex discrimination includes discrimination on the basis of pregnancy as well. Very similar to the Federal Pregnancy Disability Act.
It's unlawful.
That's okay. None of which
that's
I
a remedy.
But you're
but I'm getting there.
But you're about to become even more familiar with it.
All of this.
What the chair would like to do, because we have another bill which we have not, and including some concepts which we have not dealt with previously, and which will be the cause of even more consternation as we get into that, would like to close the hearing on Senate Bill 518 at this point and appoint a subcommittee made up of Senators Hill, Shoemaker, and Brensky to take up 518, and would ask Senator Hill to chair that subcommittee, and I would direct Ms. Bodkin, Ms. Hunter, Ms. Wisher, and Ms. Koffel, and any others who did not sign up to testify but wished to, direct them and their testimony to that subcommittee, and ask the members of that subcommittee to return the bill to us with their recommendations as soon as possible. Close the hearing 518 and open the hearing on Senate Bill 1051.
Okay.
Senator Hill.
Freshman orientation.
Chairman, I'm going to suggest we take a 2-minute break. For the benefit of the audience.
7-minute break and return at 5 minutes to 5. Let's everybody take a potty break and get back.
There we go.
And call Senator Larry Hill. And do you have some folks that are going to be joining you, Senator Hill?
Yes, just one to start with.
Okay.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'm Senator Larry Hill. With me is Karen Holsey. I represent District 21, Eugene Springfield. It's a pleasure to be here again on this side of the podium. You have before you an editorial from the Eugene Register-Guard dated 11-1988 that speaks to a case that occurred in Springfield last October, I believe, in which the Employment Division in Springfield was serving a particular individual who was eligible for employment services from the division. One of the folks in the division who was working with this client discovered that she was wanted under a felony warrant for arrest in the state of Washington. This individual was going through the procedure of becoming certified for targeted job tax credits and was going out on job search to obtain employment. The net result of the situation was that the folks in the local office got into a lot of trouble. And one individual was discharged, and that was Ms. Holsey, who's with me today, as a result of informing law enforcement officers that a wanted felon was being sent out on job search from the Employment Division. I'd like to go through the bill and let Karen give additional details of her situation, but I'll go through the bill first and explain what we're proposing to do, because it does more than just address that problem. This is called the whistleblower law. The whistleblower law will do several things. First of all, there's a set of definitions. It's important to note that employee means a person employed by, for the purposes of this law, employee means a person employed by or under contract with the state or any agency of or political subdivision of the state, any person authorized to act on behalf of the state or any agency of or subdivision of the state with respect to control, management, or supervision of any employee. It means employees of a public corporation created under ORS 656751, that's Safe Corporation. It includes employees of a contractor who performs services for the state, agency, or subdivision other than employees of a contractor under contract to construct a public improvement.
Cool.
And that means someone who's on a personal service contract or otherwise is providing services for the state or subdivision of the state under a contract for services.
Senator Howe.
Yeah. Larry, that one kind of went over me again. Will you say that one again?
Sub D, line 15 through 16, includes in the definition of employee for the purposes of this act employees of a contractor who performs services for the state, agency, or subdivision other than employees of a contractor under contract to construct a public improvement.
Okay.
The intent is to extend the provisions of the law to employees of people contracting to perform services rather than to build roads, for instance, or to remodel buildings. And finally, employee includes any person authorized to contract by contract to act on behalf of the state, agency, or subdivision. So we're covering public employees and people contracting to perform services for the state, an agency of the state, or a subdivision of the state. Public employer means a state or any agency or political subdivision of the state and any person authorized to act on behalf of the state or any agency or political subdivision of the state with respect to control, management, or supervision of any employee. This applies only to public employees or those acting under contract with the state or a political subdivision. It applies only to public employers. It does not apply to private employers or private employees other than these definitions. Section 3 is the first section that has real meat. It provides certain things that a public employer may not do or may do. This says that no public employer shall, A, prohibit any employee from discussing either specifically or generally with any member of the Legislative Assembly or Legislative Committee staff acting under the direction of a member of the Legislative Assembly, the activities of A, the state or any agency of or political subdivision of the state, or B, any person authorized to act on behalf of the state or any agency or political subdivision of the state. The next section is sub B on the next page. A public employer may not prohibit any employee from disclosing or take or threaten to take disciplinary action against an employee for the disclosure of any information that the employee reasonably believes is evidence of a violation of federal or state law, rule, or regulation, mismanagement, gross waste of funds, or abuse of authority, or substantial and specific danger to public health and safety resulting from the action of a state, agency, or political subdivision of the state. And that is to allow the employee to reveal wrongdoing, mismanagement, gross waste of funds, or abuse of authority, or danger to the public health and safety, subject to a particular provision, which I'll get to in a second. The key word is reasonably believes, is evidence of. Sub C provides that a person receiving services, and this gets to the situation in the Springfield Employment Office, a person receiving services, benefits, or assistance from the state or agency or subdivision is subject to a felony warrant for arrest issued by this state or any other state of the federal government, the provision is no public employer shall, subject to subsection 2 of this act, require any, let's see, we have, we have a small typo in there. Subject to subsection 2 of section 5 of this act, the fact that a person receives services, benefits, or assistance from the state is subject to a felony warrant for arrest. That should be reveals, may not reveal that a person receiving services, benefits, or assistance from the state or agency or subdivision is subject to a felony warrant for arrest. And let me go on and...
Where do you insert that, Larry?
That would be on line 9.
Okay.
Oh, okay, here it is. Excuse me, I'm reading it wrong. No employer may, go back up to sub B, prohibit any employee from disclosing or take or threaten to take disciplinary action against an employee for the disclosure of any information that the employee reasonably believes is evidence of, then jump down to sub C, subject to subsection 2 of section 5 of this act, the fact that a person receiving services, benefits, or assistance from the state or agency is subject to a felony warrant for arrest, etc. And then no employer may require any employee to give notice prior to making any disclosure or engaging in discussion described in this section. And finally, the employer may not discourage, restrain, dissuade, coerce, prevent, or otherwise interfere with disclosure or discussions described in this section. And sub 2, no public employer shall invoke or impose any disciplinary action against an employee for employee activity described in subsection 1 of this section or section 5 of this act. Section 4 has some exceptions to the ability to disclose, and those include that an employee may not speak for the agency unless they have authority to speak for the agency, that the employee doesn't have the authority to leave the employee's assigned work areas during normal work hours without following applicable rules and policies pertaining to leaves. It also provides that the act is not intended to authorize an employee to represent the employee's personal opinions as the opinions of the agency or subdivision, that the act is not intended to authorize an employee to disclose information required to be kept confidential under federal law, rule, or regulation. So a federal law, rule, or regulation would override this act. And also the act is not intended to restrict or preclude disciplinary action against an employee if the information disclosed by the employee is known by the employee to be false, that the employee discloses the information with reckless disregard for its truth or falsity, or the information disclosed relates to the employee's own violations, mismanagement, gross waste of funds, abuse of authority, or endangerment of the public health or safety. That section in particular, lines 31 through 35, is intended to prevent abuse of the protections provided under this act by an employee who may act through other than honorable motives. Section 5 provides the reporting of a person who's subject to a felony warrant. It states, in order to protect the safety of the citizens of this state, it is the policy of the state that all public employers and their employees cooperate with law enforcement officials in the apprehension of a person subject to a felony warrant for arrest.
Can I jump in there for a second?
Sure.
Go back up to sub 5.
Okay.
would you have any objection to working with me on an amendment which would permit the someone who was the target of false, misleading,
otherwise... Who suffers personal damages?
Who suffers personal damages, that we make an amendment to the tort limit.
I think that's my...
immunity statute in order to permit that person to come back against A, the person who did it, and B, the agency.
Now, that would be beneficial in further discouraging abuse.
Exactly.
And I think that's a good motion.
All right. Let's have counsel work on such an amendment. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Section 5, notwithstanding any other law, when an employee reasonably believes that a person receiving services, benefits, or assistance from the state or any agency or political subdivision in the state is subject to a felony warrant for arrest, the employee shall promptly and without delay do two things: notify their immediate supervisor and call the state police. And the language continues, the notification required by this subsection shall include the disclosure of the name and address of the person, available information concerning the felony warrant for arrest, and other available identifying information. Sub 4 says, information disclosed under this section shall only be used by law enforcement officials to verify the existence of a felony warrant for arrest of the person and to apprehend the person if a felony warrant for arrest exists. This is to prevent the contact with the newspaper that so-and-so is a client and we think she's subject to a felony warrant for arrest. The state police have the responsibility to make that determination. The information would be required to be turned over to state police. They'd run it through their law enforcement data system or an equivalent system and make the determination, but the information may not otherwise be released concerning a client. Otherwise, confidentiality laws prevail.
Chairman, Senator Schumer. I have two questions. There are two ways to read your sub 4.
Mm-hmm.
Since sub 2 requires that the employee shall promptly notify his or her supervisor and shall notify the Oregon State Police, which of course are law enforcement officials, you could read sub 4 to read shall only be used by law enforcement officials to verify the existence of the felony warrant, thus limiting the Oregon State Police, but not limiting the supervisor.
Then we could address that perhaps by putting a comma after used. No, that would...
You see my problem?
Yes, I do.
We need to straighten that out.
The information is already known. We can assume that the client information is available.
But what I'm suggesting is that we need to have some constraint on the supervisor, that the supervisor not use the information other than in concert with law enforcement officials to verify or something of that sort.
I understand your concern, Senator, and I agree with it. May I suggest that confidentiality laws, if they're otherwise applied, except for...
We wouldn't want to have this create an exception.
Okay. Then.
And then another question I had, mm-hmm. under Section 5, Sub 2, you direct that an employee shall,
mm-hmm.
notify his supervisor and the state police, but I don't find any sanction in here if the employee fails to do that.
Did no, that's
correct. Intend one?
There is no sanction if the employee fails to do that. This is a directive rather than a punitive. It's mandatory in the sense that it has a shall. If the employee does not do that, they would be subject to internal rules, but I'm not providing in the current language a sanction against the employer for not doing that.
I guess I'm wondering if we want to, if that's good policy to have a directive without sanctions, and then the implications of having a directive, and what if you, for whatever reason, don't do it?
Mm-hmm. We could easily put a sanction in.
Well, there might, you know, I can think of reasons why you wouldn't want to require an employee to rat on,
mm-hmm.
a relative, for instance, and yet this would require that they do so. I mean, it gets really sticky.
We can provide that there shall be enforcement provided by rule within each agency or something along those lines.
But, yeah, that's...
It's a policy choice that the committee can make. It's not, the purpose is to achieve reporting.
Yeah.
So if the committee feels that a sanction would be more effective, that's fine with me.
After it's worked for a while, we can find out whether we had any cases where that was a problem.
Section 6, Mr. Chairman, provides additional new language. In addition to appeal proceeding for a state employee and comparable provisions for employees of political subdivisions, remedies, an employee alleging a violation of Section 3 may bring a civil action for appropriate injunctive relief or damages. And this is an action for that would allow prompt response by a court pending resolution of a dispute through the normal practices of unfair employment practices. So the civil action for appropriate injunctive relief or damages, for instance, would reinstate an employee who's been fired or something along that lines while the process moves ponderously through its paces. Section 7 is existing law that we're amending. Currently, there is protection against revealing the identity of an employee who discloses information which the employee reasonably believes shows any of the following: violation of any rule, law or rule, gross waste of funds, abuse of authority, specific danger to public health or safety. That's existing law. So, and the other section, Section 3, we're not proposing something brand new. What we're doing is extending the protections, because the current protection is only protecting the identity of the person telling about it in an investigation. In an investigation. So if the employee reveals on their own motion, they don't have the benefit of current protections against revealing their identity. Also, there's no outright prohibition against them receiving sanctions if they reveal on their own motion.
Question, why are we taking out subs 2 and 3?
Because, Mr. Chairman, the protections in Section 2 and 3 of the Act would substitute for those and do everything they do and more.
Do they extend to public corporations?
It would not. You mean a publicly held corporation?
Yeah, no. Public corporation created under ORS 656751.
Oh, yes. Yes, SAFE. It covers SAFE.
And the Oregon Resources and Technology Development Corporation.
Don't believe it does.
And the what was the other one we did with the? We've got a state. We've got a fund that's out there that's a public corporation for employee buyouts and et cetera and so forth. Is that a corporation?
No, that's a contracting agency. It would be subject as a contracting agency providing services. For instance, that's CESCO. I'm on the board of that organization. We contract with the Economic Development Corporation or Department for certain activities, and we would be subject because we're contracting to provide services. Section 8 provides existing statute to include the provisions of the bill. Section 9 is the emergency clause. I'd like to point out that in Section 7, the current protections about revealing information, the protections for the employee, not only is triggered to an investigation, but is triggered to Chapter 441 and parts of 443, which deal with health care facilities. So it's not a very broad protection. So we go well beyond that with this act. I'd like to address just a couple issues, and then I'll turn it over to Karen and the other people testifying. Does the legislature have an interest and a right to find out what's going on in public agencies? Yes. Mason's Manual, 1989. This rule book governs not only this committee's actions, but the Legislative Assembly's actions. Rights of a legislative body to make investigations. Number one, this is on page 557. The right of a legislative body to make investigations in order to assist it in the preparation of wise and timely laws must exist as an indispensable incident and auxiliary to the proper exercise of legislative power. Number two, the legislature has the power to investigate any subject regarding which it desires information in connection with a proper discharge of its function to enact, amend, or repeal statutes, or to perform any other act delegated to it by the Constitution. Sub 3, the power and duty reposed in the legislature and in each and every member of both houses, therefore, thereof, is that of preparing and proceeding to enact wise and well-formed and needful laws, and in the preparation of such laws, the necessity of investigation of some sort must exist as an indispensable incident. Sub 6, the legislature has power to investigate any subject where there is a legitimate use of that legislature can make of the information sought, and an ulterior purpose in the investigation or an improper use of the information cannot be imputed. And number 10, an investigation into the management of various institutions of the state and the departments of the state government is at all times a legitimate function of the legislature. Legislature does have authority and the responsibility to investigate what's going on in state agencies. And that's the primary purpose of that sub A in Section 3. So very important part of this bill, and we need not to leave it out. I'd like to turn it over to Karen at this point and let her say a little bit about her situation.
Could you introduce yourself for the record and present your testimony?
My name is Karen Halsey, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 1051. Until November 8, 1988, I was an employee in the state of Oregon's Employment Division for over 12 years. I was terminated for what the state of Oregon called a flagrant violation of Employment Division policy. That flagrant violation was to notify a parole and probation officer that a particular person had come into the building. The only way that I could identify this person was to have her pointed out to me by a co-worker. Once the person was pointed out to me, I notified the parole and probation officer that the individual he was looking for had arrived in the building. I had no idea why the parole and probation officer wanted to speak to this person, and it was only when I read about it in the Springfield News that I became aware of this person's name. I am currently appealing that dismissal both through the union and privately. As a citizen of this state, I am certainly disturbed that a state employee can be fired for assisting the police in apprehending a wanted felon. And to go along with that, I have a letter from the Springfield Police Association that says, the Springfield Police Association is appalled that a policy exists that prevents notification of known wanted felons. We are incensed that a state employee would lose her job to maintain a wanted felon's unreasonable expectation of confidentiality. As I understand Senator Hill's proposed bill, my actions, if it had been law, would not have been grounds for dismissal, but rather would have been required. All I did was assist the police in finding someone that had a warrant to arrest. I should not have been fired by the state of Oregon for that. And going through other things, I've read several laws, bills, and I contacted Senator Hill about this to find out kind of where I stood at on that. And I found out that, you know, some of the things, I didn't give a name, an address, social security number, or a description of the woman when I told the parole officers that she was there. So I don't really know why they would fire me for that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Jones.
The woman was arrested, and she was wanted on a felony warrant for parole violation in Clark County, Washington, relating to drug felony offense. The situation is, should we accept policies in the state or permit policies in the state whereby a state agency, in essence, refuses to reveal that someone receiving services, in this case someone being sent out to look for work in the private sector, is a wanted felon? I think not.
Senator Schumer.
Yes, maybe, I don't know whether anybody's here on the other side of your incident. If they are not. What justification did your employer give for firing you for doing this? I mean, why were they so upset?
Well, they said it was a flagrant violation of Employment Division policies on
confidentiality. Well, yeah, but what did that mean? I mean, why? What were they upset about?
The confidentiality rules, saying that you can't disclose to police agencies that a wanted person is in your office. You have to go through a chain of command, which goes up to the administrator, and he makes up his mind whether or not you can turn a person in. I always thought that was aiding and abetting.
So why did they have that person in the office anyway?
For a targeted jobs tax credit program that the state has.
She was eligible.
She applied for it. She was eligible because she was a felon.
A convicted felon.
Well,
the next felon. Yeah.
We didn't know that until she told us. Through a roundabout way of going through, we had to, we knew she was on parole, so we have to contact her parole officer to find out if this, in fact, is true. By contacting the parole officer, he said she was wanted. He wanted to know where she was at because they wanted to arrest her.
Okay, so let me, can I interject here?
Did you have another question?
No, I've been trying to get a hold of this.
Yeah, one. Someone else in your office there in Springfield was working with this person on a placement.
Right.
That the person who was on had a felony warrant out against them disclosed that, in fact, they were eligible for this program by virtue of the fact that they were on parole.
Right.
Your coworker asked you to verify or otherwise contact a parole officer?
No.
I'm missing the chain of what
happened was the person that did the targeted jobs tax credit became very upset when he found this out and wanted to know what he should do.
Found out what?
That she was a wanted felon.
How did he determine that?
By calling the parole officer.
Why was the parole officer called?
Because when we fill these out, it's a requirement of ours that we have to contact the parole officer, write down their name and phone number, so that when it goes up to our central office,
they can contact them and verify that they are eligible for them. So in other words, what happened was that because of information disclosed to your coworker by this person who was wanted and innocently going to call that parole officer to find out whether this was the person in question and was eligible for this assistance, the parole officer volunteered to your coworker that there was a want out on this person and what the heck are they doing in your office?
Basically.
Worse to that effect. Is that right?
Basically.
Okay. Mm-hmm. At which point your coworker came to you and said, you're not going to believe this, but this person over here who is in here trying to get assistance is actually warrant or a felony warrant out of Clark County, Washington. Correct?
When he found out that by talking to the parole officer that she was wanted, then he became very upset, and I asked him what his problem was, because he was sitting back there moaning and groaning, and I'm going, wait, you know, there's something wrong here. What's wrong with you? And he told me that, and I said, well, go to the manager and tell him what your problem is.
And what happened then?
Then I went back to my desk.
And then what happened?
Then the there was a meeting that all the supervisors and manager went to.
Mm-hmm.
And I was lead person in that particular part of the office. So when she came in, a coworker pointed her out to me, told me to go next door and tell the parole and probation's officer that she was in the office. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did.
You were directed to do this?
Yes, I was.
By whom were you directed to do this?
A
superior?
Coworker. No, a
coworker. Coworker. An equal. A mm-hmm. co-equal in the office.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. At that point, you did. And they came and picked this person up?
No.
No. What happened?
Well, then when I was over there telling him that she was there, another coworker came over and said, don't say anything. And I said, well, you're too late.
Damage is done.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then they went over to visit with this person?
No.
Yeah.
What did they do?
What?
Well, then she left. And I found out later that they waited for her to leave because of the way the doors are. They waited for her to leave. When she got outside of our office, then they instructed her to come into their office, and then they arrested her over there.
At that point.
Right.
Okay.